the hour's top story. Czech communist leaders are reported to have left Prague by plane, apparently for a crucial meeting with Soviet communist leaders. This is Don Doak, NBC News, Washington.
Listen again on the hour when True Filter Cigarettes bring you NBC Monitor News on the Hour.
The San Francisco story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear, with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story.
Does a diller a dollar, a 10 o'clock scholar ring a bell? Of course, it's that old nursery rhyme that many of us may remember from further back than we care to remember. But for today's parents, it should ring another bell, as a reminder that school will be starting again in only 4 more weeks. And that means that now is the time to schedule an appointment with your medical eye doctor to have your child's eyes checked, to make sure that when your scholar starts back to school, he won't be handicapped by poor vision. It's a good feeling to know your children's eyes are all right, and if they aren't, it's a good feeling, too, to know that you had them corrected before they got worse. For your child's sake, make an appointment tomorrow with your medical eye doctor just in case his schedule is full later on. Remember, look to him for the best in eye care. Look to Jenkel Davidson for the best in eye wear. Now to our story. It was in the early 1930s that a strange incident of no great importance was given space for a day or so in the local press. You remember the early 1930s, the days when erstwhile gentlemen of wealth were selling apples on street corners, when banks were tottering and incomes were crashing, when the highways that led to the cities were the parade ground of bums and blanket roll tramps. Wayside fires glowed in 1,000 hobo jungles along the train tracks, and 8 million men were unemployed. Well, during that period, smoke was seen one day emerging from a vault in Calvary Cemetery. The word vault is used too loosely. It was a mausoleum, an imposing structure of stone with stained glass windows and bronze doors. It was a tomb that plainly said, "This is the last resting place of a graveyard aristocrat." It was a structure proclaiming in flamboyant elegance the snobbery of the graveyard. It was as ugly a mass of misguided architecture as one could find in a long search through the graveyards and the avenues and streets of a city that had long been famous for its architectural abortions. And there it sat in the serene quiet of Calvary Cemetery, and a stained glass window had been removed, and through the aperture projected a stovepipe, and out of the stovepipe drifted smoke. Smoke fragrant with the aroma of fried bacon and burned beans. Now, San Francisco had always been famed for its strange characters and strange events, and much might go unnoticed here that would have caused alarms and excursions and riots in a city of more prosaic traditions. But smoke flavored with the aroma of frying bacon emerging from a stovepipe thrust through the window of an architectural graveyard monstrosity was more than even the police of San Francisco could accept. So they investigated. And they found the bronze door of the vault had been crashed, and the interior of the mausoleum had become the pleasant, if perhaps cheerless, home of a group of itinerants. They had set up housekeeping there, had lived there in comparative comfort, rent-free, for several months. Whereupon the police drove them forth, and whether or not they were given new lodgings as vagrants in the Hall of Justice, I do not know. But the mausoleum returned to its erstwhile undisturbed serenity, a silent home of the dead. Which, from any point of view that you may approach the question, seems a pity. For if ever there was a man who would have enjoyed the company of those down-and-out, poverty-stricken bums of the 1930s, it was the man whose mortal remains rested beneath the stones of that architectural abomination. His name was William O'Brien, and having lived a simple and modest life without pomp or circumstance, his only claim to elegant ostentation was the tomb that he had commanded to be built just a few months before his death. And now we shall again turn to Oscar Lewis' fine book, The Silver Kings, for our story. William O'Brien, William Shoney O'Brien, came to San Francisco from New York City on July 6th in 1849. He was 23 years old, and he didn't have a dollar in his pocket. He had been born in Dublin, Ireland. He had come with a constant stream of emigrants that turned to America as the land of promise when political and economic turmoil had made the going harder than usual for the underdogs of the social pattern. He worked as a grocery clerk in New York. He was one of tens of thousands of young Irish lads, all waiting for opportunity or lady luck to beckon. But the lady was busy in a thousand other paths, so young Bill O'Brien pulled the shelves of the grocery store down around his ears and sailed away to California to hunt for gold. Bill O'Brien arrived in San Francisco in July of 1849, and he found San Francisco an all but deserted village. Overnight, the village had become a city, and as quickly it had emptied itself into the hills. Oh, there was activity, of course. To call it a deserted village was a misstatement. Daily ships were dropping anchor off Clark's Point, jetsaming their human cargoes on Clark's Wharf, and up Clay and up Pacific Street toiled the wide-eyed, shamble-footed, never-ending parade of excited humanity. This was San Francisco. This was the place they'd heard the fabulous stories about. San Francisco, where unschooled farmers and street bums were becoming millionaires overnight. San Francisco. But one glance at the dance hall, saloon, and gambling hall-lined streets was enough. It certainly wasn't for this that they'd traveled 6 months around the Cape or over the Isthmus or by tortuous trails across the prairies and the Rockies. No, sir. They had come for gold. Gold that could be picked up on the trails, that glistened in the crotches of pine trees, that leaped at you, yellow and shining, every time you swung a pick. Yes, the human cargoes all landed in San Francisco, and so with one glance at the sprawling village of San Francisco, one quick sizing up of the bay with its skeleton yard of deserted ships, and they were all off to the hills. By riverboat, by burroback or horseback, or on Shank's mare, they all headed for the mother lode. But not Bill O'Brien. Gold meant little to him either then or later. He landed, penniless, his stock of worldly possessions on his back, consisting of a badly tattered homespun, and he got a job unloading ships in the bay. It was a rough, tough job, unloading the heterogeneous army of ships that dropped anchor off Clark's Point. The cargoes of rubber boots and calicoes and coffee and sugar and tobacco and rum had to be carried on strong shoulders up the beach and through roadways ankle-deep in dust in summer, knee-deep in mud in winter and in spring. One day a chance acquaintance stopped the tall, good-looking young Irish lad, remonstrated with him for the ragged appearance of his dress and the tatters of his shoes. But there was nothing much Bill O'Brien could do about that. Boots and shoes in San Francisco cost from $20 to $50 a pair. So the acquaintance presented him with a pair of shoes that, although they had done some service, were still better than nothing, and O'Brien found the going easier. And years later, he made a persistent effort to find the Samaritan who had come to his aid, but without avail. After all, it was no small matter to have a pair of reasonably serviceable boots shoved on feet that were torn and bleeding from the hazards of the roadway. The fact is, William O'Brien found all men friendly creatures. There were men of all kinds who had made the journey from New York with him on the brig Terralinta, rich men and poor men, adventurers and scholars, and they'd all been friendly disposed to the young Irishman. In later years, he liked to remember that friendships won when a lad was penniless were friendships worth having. Not very ambitious, Bill O'Brien drifted through the years of the gold rush, making friends, enjoying life in its simplest form. But the ships that masked the bay were now ghost ships. Fewer cargoes were coming into the harbor. Fewer men were heading for the diggings, and more men were drifting back broke. And so O'Brien sought a job more sure to supply him with three meals a day. He clerked in a tobacco and newspaper shop owned by William C. Hoff, and he eventually became Hoff's partner. He saved a little money, and then he bought an interest in W.J. Rossner's ship chandlery. That was a business designed to kindle the imagination of any young lad, for through the chandlery doors came the endless string of skippers and mates and pursers from ships that had spoken every port of the seas. There were few pursuits more glamorous. And more than that, the business of ship chandlering was vaguely related to horse trading. Sharp deals were made, close corners were cut, and any deal was a transaction as long as it didn't make a barefaced practice of breaking the laws. At least, not too often. It invested O'Brien with a degree of shrewdness he hadn't before possessed. And it increased his knowledge of men, which at no time had been a shortcoming of his. And during the days in Rossner's chandlery, he met and learned to like another young Irishman, a store clerk named Jim Flood. Meanwhile, hard times were closing in on San Francisco. The harvest of the gold fields had thinned out. 6 fires had laid the city low. The streets were overrun with hoodlums and escaped convicts from the penal settlements of Australia and New Zealand. Banks were failing. The vigilantes were creating their own rules of order, and death by common causes were no more frequent than were murders and hangings. The city was passing through its bleakest, blackest hours. Now, ship chandleries didn't do much business, but saloons were always full, so pooling their resources, both having saved a reasonably comfortable nest egg, Bill O'Brien and Jim Flood opened a saloon. The year was 1857. Their establishment for the dispensing of hard liquor stood at the corner of Pacific and Stockton Streets. Not a very good location. Business with the growth of the city was moving south, so they soon sought and found a new location at 509 Washington Street, just west of Sansom. They called their place the Auction Lunch, and their clientele was largely drawn from the commission and auction houses that prevailed in the district. One feature of the Flood O'Brien Saloon was the high quality of their free lunch counter. A merchant, an auctioneer, a banker, or a bum could come in and buy a glass of beer for a nickel or whiskey for a little more and eat to his heart's content. And so it took very little time for the Auction Lunch to become the most popular gathering place of big and little men in the city. We'll get back to our story in a moment. People tend to associate forgetfulness with a certain age, beginning about 40. Of course, the association has no medical basis. But if there is a coincidence between 40 and forgetfulness, perhaps it's because by that age, a person has more to remember in past experience and in present responsibilities. Small wonder that small matters sometimes get overlooked, like, what did I do with my glasses? More people do start asking that question about 40 because that's the age when the daily strains on our vision begin to catch up with us. That's why you shouldn't forget to see your medical eye doctor every 18 months or so at any age, but especially past 40. And if you have trouble keeping track of your glasses, maybe you should have a practical second pair of prescription sunglasses. They're doubly useful in the sun and as a spare standby. Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving you throughout Northern California. Bank credit cards honored. Now, back to the story of Bill O'Brien. Jim Flood, innately a gentleman, dressed like a gentleman, and preferred to mingle with his patrons on the floor of the auction lunch as one of them. But not Bill O'Brien. O'Brien wore his white apron, he stood behind the bar, he made change for the gold coins that were flung on the bar, he was a bartender, and because that was his job, he was proud of it. He liked people, and people liked him. And where could you meet more and different kinds of men than when you were dispensing hard liquor across the mahogany of the Flood O'Brien Saloon? There was no pretense, no affectation about William O'Brien. He was a plain, earthy man who liked people as long as they met him on his own ground. 509 Washington Street was a busy place, and that block on Washington Street was to become increasingly important. For next to the Flood O'Brien establishment was the Washington Market, the most important and heavily patronized market in the city, and all the important people went there. Many a gentleman combined his duties at the market with his pleasures at the friendly place next door. But more important than the market was, in the coming in 1862 of the San Francisco Mining Exchange to a location just a few doors west of Flood and O'Brien's. And now even more distinguished patrons found their way into the place of liquid refreshment, and the two proprietors spruced up their garb in a manner befitting the new clientele. O'Brien wore broadcloth and a high silk hat, and the very picture of a man of distinction. He liked to stand on the sidewalk and greet friends. Flood, more sedate, more well-tailored, wore suits of fashionable gray. He was less boisterous in his greeting of friends, but he always was willing to listen when they talked. And listening, he learned much of the trend of the mines, especially the fabulous gold and silver mines recently developed in a hillside above Virginia City in the territory of Nevada. Oh, tips were generously given, and with the shrewd perception that characterized all of his activities, James Flood played the tips that were sound and rejected the unstable ones. And good-natured Billy O'Brien played along with him. And the result was that 10 years after they had become partners, through playing tips on the mining exchange, Flood and O'Brien were reasonably wealthy men. Well, the next and obvious step was the disposing of the auction lunch. And the sale was made. Flood and O'Brien moved out and opened offices in a loft on Montgomery Street as mining stockbrokers. And to their office came two more Irish gentlemen who had started, as they had done, with nothing. But these men were practical miners, experts in their fields. They were John Mackey and James Fair. Briefly, Mackey was a mining wizard and a shrewd businessman. Fair was a hard, vindictive, cold individual, climbing to heights no matter the necks he trod on. Flood was a wise businessman with the untried instincts of a financier, and O'Brien, well, Bill O'Brien made no pretense. He wasn't much of a businessman. He simply, as he liked to tell it, grabbed hold of the tail of a kite and was heisted up into the air. It was a swift and dazzling ascent. For within 4 years after they had sold the auction lunch, James Flood and William O'Brien were, according to various authorities, enjoying an income of more than $500,000 a month. William O'Brien never married, but he bought himself a rather pretentious home at 517 Sutter Street, just above Powell. Not that he wanted to make a splurge with his millions, but the house was large, and to it he could bring his various brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and lavish comforts and luxuries upon them. He was an important member of the Society of San Francisco Financial Leaders, but he refused to accept the honor or the responsibility, for it wasn't his fault that he had made millions that he had never particularly wanted. Bill O'Brien went along his easy, happy way, just as unassuming, just as matter-of-fact an everyday individual as he had been years before when a friend had given him a pair of serviceable boots in his stevedoring days. He liked to remember those friends of his early days in San Francisco, and he liked to gather them around him and give parties and banquets for the friends that he had known back on the brig Terralinta. And in 1877, he chartered a tug and took 50 of his Terralinta friends on a tour of the bay. And speeches were made, and a brass band played, and everybody sang, "Oh, Susanna." And the following year, Bill O'Brien died. Bill O'Brien had never wanted very much of life. Just good friends and good food and time to relax and take things easy. And he died, leaving a fortune variously stated to have ranged from $6 to $15 million. His fortune went to friends and to his immediate relatives and to his favorite charities. And his only gesture of ostentation, his only futile extravagance, was the mausoleum he ordered built in Calvary Cemetery. The place with the bronze doors and stained windows, through one of which hobos of 1930 had thrust a stovepipe to let out the smoke from the bacon they were frying. And you know, I think Bill O'Brien would have enjoyed that. For a few thousand years, alchemy was very big on the scene. Its chief aim was to change lead into gold, and eventually it decayed into the classic forerunner of all con games. The only gold that alchemy ever produced was that handed over by hopeful sponsors to the glib alchemists. But out of alchemy came something ultimately finer than gold. Alchemy laid the basis for the science of chemistry, which has produced rewards aplenty. In the field of vision, for instance, chemistry has contributed greatly to the preservation of good eyesight in the form of effective medications and in the form of corrective lenses. And here's another step forward. Now you can enjoy uniformly colored sunglasses made in your regular prescription, whatever your degree of correction. These Jenkel Davidson sunglasses are better to look at and to look through because they're like regular sunglasses. No telltale darker and lighter areas on the lenses. So see them soon at Jenkel Davidson. Bank credit cards honored. You have been the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for the San Francisco story. The men and women of Jenkel Davidson hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall tell the story of the Rose of Sharon, a most unusual lady of early San Francisco. Many of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book, Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. This is Bud Heide, speaking for the Jenkel Davidson Optical Company with offices throughout Northern California.
This is KNBR, AM and FM in San Francisco at 9:30. The weather picture for today, fair weather except the persistent fog near the ocean and local morning overcast inland. The high today in the city, 58, Oakland 66. San Rafael may have 80 degrees.
Claus is coming again. Cheer up, you pilgrims, be joyful and sing. Jesus is coming again.
This is the voice of prophecy. A voice crying in the wilderness of these modern days, prepare ye the way of the Lord.